listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A look ahead at the work cut out for the United Nations in 2018, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke about his priorities for the year at the General Assembly in New York in an informal meeting Tuesday. This is Secretary General Antonio Guterres at the United Nations in New York.
I took office last year calling for us to make 2017 a year for peace. 1 year later, we must recognize that peace remains elusive. In fundamental ways, the world has gone in reverse. Conflicts have deepened and new dangers have emerged. Global anxieties about nuclear weapons are the highest since the Cold War. And climate change is moving faster than we are. Inequalities are growing. We see horrific violations of human rights. And nationalism, racism, and xenophobia are on the rise. And to me, these are all indications that we need greater unity and courage. Unity and courage to meet today's most urgent needs, to ease the fears of the people we serve, and to set the world on track towards a better future. It is up to member states to define the priorities of UN action. But today, I will highlight 12 areas of concern and one cross-cutting imperative, the empowerment of women everywhere. Excellence.
1. Promote a true new deal for a globalization that's fair. Poverty and inequalities are not unavoidable. Nor is the unequal distribution of the benefits of globalization an unavoidable result. It's not by chance if 8 individuals possess as much wealth as half the poorest population in the world, The way the global economy and international trade work is the result of choices made by human beings. Our choice is the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. Our ambition is to build, construct prosperous and peaceful societies for all without leaving anyone on the side of the road. Financing is essential to achieve this goal. The Addis Ababa Program of Action sets out the needs and the way of raising resources, in particular by using innovative mechanisms. And I would like to once again make an appeal to governments, and in particular to donors, to fulfill their financing pledges. And I urge the international community to establish effective mechanisms to combat tax evasion, money laundering, and illegal flows of capital so that developing countries can better take advantage of their own resources. By repositioning the United Nations system for development, we want to help member states to better achieve the sustainable development goals, and we need to take advantage of the dynamic development of the private sector and of civil society. And of course, young people deserve need to have a particularly important place in this process. We need to invest in their future. Second, significantly raise our ambitions in terms of combating climate change. In 2016, for the first time in 3 years, CO2 emissions have increased. The five past years have been the hottest years on record. The Paris Accord established the framework for action. However, the commitments undertaken so far will not be enough to attain the goals established. We will need to also raise our ambitions on this point. Luckily, the opportunities for action to combat climate change have never been as significant as today. I have heard that it said that the Stone Age did not end because of a lack of stones. Well, nothing. It's useless to wait until we have no more coal or oil to leave the age of fossil fuels. We need to develop the green economy so that our Earth has a future. We need to invest in the future, not in the past. Next year, I will organize a summit on the climate to mobilize partners in order to mitigate the effects of climate change, adapting to climate change, and to energy transition, which we need so much. Third, take advantage of human mobility. The adoption of the global pact for safe, ordered, and regular migration is one of the most important tasks that we will need to accomplish this year. I've said it before and I'll repeat it. Migrations are a positive phenomenon. Migration promotes economic growth, reduces inequalities, establishes connections between societies, and helps us tackle demographic challenges. But they also are at the heart of political tensions and human tragedies. This is why we need to create many more opportunities for legal migration and give people an opportunity to work and live in dignity in their own countries as a key goal of the our strategy for development and our strategy for development cooperation. This is the only way for us to combat against smugglers and traffickers and to protect those who are the victims of these individuals. Your Excellencies, fourthly, we need to take advantage of the benefits of the fourth industrial revolution while we protect ourselves from its threats. Technological progress can help provide responses to the most urgent challenges of today's world. At the same time, we know that technology can exacerbate inequality. Artificial intelligence will have a dramatic impact on labor markets and societies. Genetic engineering implies serious ethical dilemmas. Cybersecurity threats are increasing and privacy is at risk. The United Nations are committed to serve as a forum where member states, the private sector, scientists, scientists and civil society can engage in debate on the path to take in the future on these issues, as well as to control their potential to benefit everyone.
Fifth, achieving the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula without sleepwalking our way into calamity. I welcome the firm decisions the Security Council has taken in response to nuclear tests and ballistic missile launches by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. They must be fully implemented. But the Council unity also paves the way for diplomatic engagement. That is why last month I sent the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs to Pyongyang for the first in-depth political exchange of views between the United Nations Secretariat and the DPRK officials in almost 8 years. I welcome the reopening of inter-Korean communication channels, especially military to military. This is critical to lower the risk of miscalculation or misunderstanding and to reduce tensions. I'm also encouraged by the decision of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to participate in the upcoming Winter Olympics in the Republic of Korea. I will be there myself in the opening ceremony. We need to build on these small signs of hope and expand diplomatic efforts to achieve the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula in the context of regional security. Six, disengaging the mess in the broader Middle East. The situation in the broader Middle East has become a Gordian knot. With so many interrelated flashpoints, the risk of an escalatory cycle is real. We must press for a return to negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. There is no alternative to a two-state solution, and recent signals of diminishing support for these undermine moderates and empower radicals. There is no plan B. In Lebanon, let us all work to preserve the country's sovereignty and stability and strengthen state institutions. In Yemen, it's time for the parties to enter into meaningful peace negotiations beyond the efforts to ease the dramatic humanitarian catastrophe. Looking at the Gulf, we must seize all opportunities to establish and strengthen platforms for regional dialogue to ease tensions, to avoid escalations, and allow for political solutions to emerge. In Syria, the United Nations will continue its engagements toward genuine, representative, and direct inter-Syrian negotiations in Geneva, leading to a political settlement of the conflict. And in Iraq, we will support all efforts to ensure the country's territorial integrity, pursue inclusive governance, and ease sectarian tensions. Seventh, strengthening our partnership with the African Union. I'm a strong believer in African-led solutions to African problems. The African Union and the United Nations have a shared interest in strengthening mechanisms to defuse conflicts before they escalate and to manage them effectively where they occur. It is essential for the international community to fully support the efforts of the African Union and sub-regional organizations, especially when traditional peacekeeping models are not enough and where peace enforcement and counterterrorism are needed. An effective and well-funded African peace and security architecture remains a global strategic imperative. In Somalia, around Lake Chad, as well as in the Sahel, African forces require solid support from the international community and the United Nations with clear mandates and adequate and predictable financing. And I also remain totally committed to supporting Libyan actors in securing a political agreement and fully implementing the roadmap presented by my special representative, leading to parliamentary and presidential elections. Eighth, removing the paralysis that has left European conflicts fester and freeze. Having started two world wars and taking into account the resources and capacities available to Europe, it is unjustifiable for conflicts in the region to persist. Resolving these situations requires pushing back the dangerous tide of nationalism and revitalizing the relevant mediation initiatives, including the Normandy format and trilateral contact group on eastern Ukraine, the OSCE Minsk group on Nagorno-Karabakh, Geneva international discussions related to Georgia and 5+2 process on Transnistria. A concerted effort for solutions leading to long-term stability in the Western Balkans is also urgent. And I urge European leaders to show that the continent can live up to its ideals of shared prosperity and peaceful coexistence. Ninth, maintaining a strong focus on counterterrorism. There are distinct links between conflicts and the spread of terrorism. It is clear that in countries like Afghanistan, moves towards peace would advance the fight against the terrorism that plagues that country and spreads well beyond its borders. Terrorism needs globally coordinated responses to defeat it. And in June, I will convene a summit of heads of counterterrorism agencies to advance multilateral cooperation in this vital struggle. It is also critical to focus on root causes and support victims. Our actions must be grounded in respect for human rights and the rule of law, and we must avoid approaches that feed the grievances and narratives that may generate the very violence we seek to eliminate. In short, in preventing and combating terrorism, we should be both tough and smart. Tenth, strengthening United Nations peace operations. Peacekeeping is facing unprecedented challenges. Our missions are increasingly deployed in difficult environments where there is little peace to keep. Many times ill-equipped, our peacekeepers are now deliberately targeted. This situation is not sustainable. It's time to sound an alarm. I am determined to improve our peacekeeping performance, to better protect ourselves and the populations we serve. A detailed plan of action for that purpose is being prepared by the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. But we can only do it with more engagement and support from all member states, as troop or police contributors, as financial contributors, as partners in political efforts and in the Security Council. I thank our troop and police contributing countries for their generosity and pay tribute to all personnel who have given their lives in the line of duty. Peacekeeping must be seen in the context of the whole peace continuum, with prevention as our clear priority. Next month, I will present to you my report on peace building and sustaining peace as required by the General Assembly, which we hope will galvanize our efforts to prevent violent conflicts. The Mediation Advisory Board is also up and running. One of its members, President Olusegun Obasanjo, has just undertaken its first initiative in support of the successful elections and political transition underway in Liberia. We have already planned a number of other missions with the agreement of the countries concerned to member states facing stability challenges. 11th, reversing the large-scale exodus of Myanmar Rohingya Muslims. Cast out of their homes and country and subjected to brutality, both by military forces and others, they are under siege as a group for who they are. They desperately need immediate life-saving assistance, long-term solutions, and justice. I call on the government to ensure unfettered humanitarian access in Rakhine State, and I appeal to the international community to support those who have fled to Bangladesh. The agreement between Bangladesh and Myanmar, I hope, will pave the way to what is needed, the safe, voluntary, dignified, and sustainable return of refugees to their places of origin in accordance with international standards that will be, of course, critical. Full implementation of the Rakhine Advisory Commission recommendations is also vital, and I remain strongly committing to support Myanmar's democratic transition through these difficult moments. 12th, overcoming the false contradiction between human rights and national sovereignty. Human rights and national sovereignty go hand in hand. The achievement of human rights strengthens states and societies, thereby reinforcing sovereignty. And states with effective, accountable institutions are among the best defenders of human rights. The United Nations stands ready to support states in building their capacities to uphold the rule of law and promote respect on human rights, all civil, political, economic, social, and cultural, and to eliminate all forms of discrimination. A vibrant civil society and free press have also central roles to play. In the seventh year of the Declaration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, let us be guided by that mighty document's aspirations and guarantees. And this is also the spirit of the Human Rights Upfront initiative, to which I remain fully committed. Ladies and gentlemen, in each of these 12 areas, we can see the disproportionate impact on women, from conflicts to climate change to mass migration. We can also see in the greater equality and inclusion of women a fundamental tool to address these complex challenges. Women's meaningful participation in peace and security has been proven to make peace more sustainable. And women's equal participation in the labor force and equal pay would unlock trillions of dollars for our economies. To achieve such gains, however, greater action is needed. And my approach rests on three pillars. First, empowerment, empowering women and girls. Power is the heart of the matter. I have launched a roadmap for achieving gender parity at all levels of the United Nations. With the appointment I announced yesterday, we have reached, far in advance, full parity in the 44 member of the United Nations Senior Management Group. I have requested that all of our reforms make explicit how they are strengthening our capacity to deliver on gender equality. And I have mandated an internal task force to review the UN's own spending on gender equality. Second, preventing sexual exploitation and abuse against women. Our organization's first ever victims' rights advocate is now in place, working closely with states and across the United Nations system. 82 member states are part of a voluntary compact to prevent these crimes and respond swiftly to allegations. 58 world leaders are showing their resolve by standing with me in a circle of leadership. There is a long way to go, but we are totally determined. Third, preventing and addressing sexual harassment. I reiterate my personal commitment to eliminate sexual harassment from our organization. My zero-tolerance approach was recently reaffirmed in a joint letter with staff unions to all our personnel. And I've also set up a task force led by Jan Beagle of the Department of Management to review UN policies and capacities to investigate, to ensure accountability, and to look at the support and protection offered to those affected. We are working on more detailed measures to simplify the procedures for reporting harassment and to raise awareness of this very serious issue throughout our organization. Excellencies, this will be a decisive year for reform. The General Assembly has taken important decisions. You have my reports and proposals, and I have listened hard to your comments and suggestions. As we have been debating it in several sessions, I will not develop the issue today. The period ahead of us must set the course towards peace and prosperity. I've just returned from a visit to Colombia, where I saw inspiring advances towards peace and reconciliation, but also the challenges that such processes inevitably entailed. I draw hope from our work there and from the courage and resilience of the Colombian people. All our challenges, everything, everywhere, demand an investment of time, money, energy, political capital, and more. Member states must assume their leadership. But everyone, everywhere can do something to make our world more safe, sustainable, and secure. Even in the face of headwinds and hatred, we must uphold the values of the United Nations Charter. But we can only do that together, as United Nations and one human family. Thank you.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking in New York on Tuesday about the plans of his administration over the coming year. At the close of that meeting, the Secretary General sat with the press and took questions, and we bring you some highlights from that session.
Sherwin Briceby, South African Broadcasting, and Secretary General, welcome back to our favorite room at the United Nations, and we certainly look forward to engaging you throughout 2018, and good luck with the 12 points. In your remarks to the General Assembly earlier, you said that the world had gone in reverse, that racism, nationalism, and xenophobia were on the rise. You will also be aware of the recent derogatory comments attributed to the United States President as it relates to immigration from Africa and Haiti. You'd also be aware, sir, of the statement from the Africa Group of Ambassadors here at the United Nations and the African Union condemning what it called outrageous, racist, and xenophobic remarks. Do you support their call for a retraction and an apology from the United States President?
Well, as far as I understand, the United States President has denied that he has said that. Our position is very clear. We need to have relations of mutual respect with all peoples in the world. And in particular, migration is a positive aspect. And migrants contribute not only to the welfare of their countries of origin, but to the welfare of the countries where they are part of the development process. The respect for migrants and the respect for diversity, ethnic diversity, religious diversity, is a fundamental pillar of the United Nations, and it will be a fundamental pillar of the action of the Secretary General.
James Bayes from Al Jazeera. You and your predecessor have repeatedly said there's no military solution in Syria. And yet right now we have Turkey readying itself for possible military action. We have the US planning a new Kurdish border security force, and we have the Syrian government, backed by the Russians, actively pursuing a military solution with a bombardment in Idlib and eastern Ghouta, and the same Syrian government, when it goes to Geneva, not engaging fully with the political process. With that backdrop, how do you reinvigorate the peace efforts, and is Sochi part of that?
I think that that backdrop only shows how important it is to revigorate the Geneva process. And to revigorate the Geneva process, we are making all efforts in order to make sure that both government and opposition give positive contributions to make the process move forward. We were in Riyadh, and I believe Riyadh too was a very important moment to bring the different strands of the opposition together and to have the opposition participating constructively. We have been, as you know, the positions we have assumed in relation to the last Geneva meeting. A new meeting was convened to Geneva, or probably to another location close to Geneva. And we hope that this time it will be possible to have constructive dialogue between government and opposition. Our position in relation to Sochi is still dependent on how things will develop in between. We believe that what you said only proves that after all these years, if so many are still betting on military operations, it is clear that there is no military solution.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. Ali Barada from Sharq al-Awsat and from France 24. A follow-up to James' question. Do you see that there is a significant role that should be played by President Bashar al-Assad in the solution that planned for Syria? And are you happy about the work that has been done by your special envoy, Stefan de Mistura, and why? Thank you.
I am happy with the work Stefan de Mistura has done. I think it's really almost a miracle that he was able to stay the course and make this process move forward with all the difficulties and all the problems and all the obstacles that we have witnessed. We have asked both government and opposition to put no preconditions for the discussion. And so I'm not going to put myself a precondition in relation to the presidency of Syria. It is essential for the two parties to come and discuss without preconditions. And of course, obviously, the questions of governance, the questions of elections, and the questions of constitution are very important. And each one is entitled to have each one's position. But what for us is more important at the present moment is to make sure that a meaningful dialogue starts between government and opposition without preconditions.
Towards a transition?
Sorry?
Towards a transition as called by Security Council Resolution 2254.
Every aspect of the resolution is on the table. Constitution, elections, and transition. We have tried to organize the debate in a way that allow it to move forward, but none of these aspects is out of the table.
Mr. Secretary General, Carol Landry from Agence France-Presse. I wanted to ask you about North Korea. Do you think that war is avoidable in 2018 with North Korea? And you mentioned small signs of hope. And some people are dismissive that sending musicians and figure skaters to the South is going to make a real difference. And while you're at the Winter Olympics, will there be an opportunity for diplomacy? Thank you.
Well, I believe war is avoidable. What I'm worried is that I'm not yet sure that peace is guaranteed. And that is why we are so strongly engaged. As you know, I've sent my Undersecretary of Political Affairs to Pyongyang. Today, I was very happy when the ambassador, the permanent representative of the Republic of Korea, said that this visit has contributed to the restart of the dialogue between the two Koreas. I think there are some signals of hope. What I believe is extremely important is to take profit of these signals of hope to make sure that a serious process leading to the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula takes place. I think there is a window of opportunity. That window of opportunity will, in my opinion, hopefully make the war available. But it is important that we don't miss the opportunities that windows can provide.
Thank you. Betulürk, Turkish news agency Anadolu. I'd like to ask about the U.S. decision to establish a border security forces on the Syrian border. The decision has already led to tension between Turkey and the U.S., and Russia also warned about a possible division in the country, and Syria sees it as an attack on its sovereignty. I was wondering if you have a comment or any concerns about this decision. Thank you.
As you know, too many countries have had troops in Syria. I think if the Syrian people could be able to solve alone its problems, it would probably be much better.
Abadi from Le Dossier du Maroc. The Chinese president said, and I quote, a good China-U.S. cooperation will serve as an anchor for global stability and a booster for world peace. In your capacity as the Secretary General of the United Nations, what importance do you attribute to these bilateral relations in the promotion of peace and security in the world?
A vital importance.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Are the mainstream media intentionally gaslighting the public against President Donald Trump? The reverse appears to be equally true. Trump does, with style, gaslight the media. What kind of body politic is this creating? Has the U.S. become a collection of hysterical drama queens? Crosstalking Gaslighting, I'm joined by my guest, Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson in Los Angeles. He is a counselor, activist, media commentator, as well as author of The Antidote, Healing America from the Poison of Hate, Blame, and Victimhood. Also in Los Angeles, we have Ron Placone. He is a comedian and a frequent guest on The Jimmy Dore Show and The Young Turks, as well as host of his own streaming program, Get Your News On with Ron. And in New York, we cross to Rob Taub. He's a political pundit and journalist contributing to The Huffington Post. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ron, let me go to you. I mean, who's gaslighting whom here? And is it a country that is just turned into a bunch of drama queens? Because from a distance, from my vantage point, my perch, it's a lot of drama queens out there not saying anything worth much listening to. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, you know, I'm with you. Here's the thing. The media was in bad shape, the corporate media in the United States. Was in very bad shape long before Trump came along, and they're still in very bad shape now. The way the media really gaslights the public is they try to make it out like everything was just hunky-dory and we had this perfectly functioning democracy where everybody was happy. And then all of a sudden Trump came along and disrupted everything. Well, in fact, that's not true. You know, I mean, if Trump is Frankenstein, the media is very much Victor. And, you know, this constant amplification and Trump, pretty much all of his policies are just general Republican policies. And I dislike these policies. I strongly dislike Trump. But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and entertain this idea that he's some big outlier when, in fact, he's kind of the result of the system we have.
Excellent point there. Rob, weigh in on that, because I think that's absolutely true here. What we're doing is we're always getting these exaggerated reactions to everything that is said. I mean, like the episode. Wow, that took, you know what, two news cycles here. I mean, I don't really care about that language. And if a country isn't, why is it? And did the U.S. have a play in it? Okay, that's an interesting policy to talk about, not about some callous vocabulary. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, I've been around for a while, and my father worked in the Johnson White House and had his first meeting with the president when the president was sitting on the toilet. So I've heard it all. I'm pretty jaded. And you and I were talking prior to the show, Peter, and I brought up a line, which I'll paraphrase from broadcast news, when Albert Brooks says, you know, that we're in trouble in the news when we become more important than the story. I feel they're beating the whole story to death enough already. He said it. He's going to say other oafish, boorish, stupid things. But I'm glad I'm doing this show with you today, because I wanted to talk about, I've been dying to talk about for a week now, that it's not like Trump has so much created this environment. You're right about the Victor Frankenstein. We've helped create him, but it's just, I think the future, unfortunately, of politics is going to be based on social media and those kind of platforms. I don't even know if we're going to go back to the bipartisanship we once had. It's become emotional. It's become ideological. And it's become instantaneous with people putting their thumbs on their phones everywhere, be they members of the press or a part of the kitchen cabinet or the president of the United States.
You know, Jesse, in Los Angeles, I mean, this is a very good point, and I'm going to take both points from what we heard from Ron and Rob here. I mean, if it's really all about Trump, then it's all about Jake Trapper. It's also about Rachel Maddow. It's about Chris Cuomo. This is of equal measure here. Personally, I find all of it quite toxic, because there are a lot of problems to solve in the U.S. and around the world. I could care less what Jake Trapper thinks about anything, to be honest with you. Okay, go ahead, Jesse. Go ahead.
You know, President Trump, I call him the Great White Hope. He will go down in history as the best president, or at least one of them for sure, but the best president that this country has ever experienced. The president, by telling the truth, being straightforward, and putting the country first, is exposing the children of the lie. And the children of the lie are the liberals, are the liberal media, the Democrats, the rhino Republicans, and the never Trumpers. They are being exposed. They never had a plan or any intent to make America great again. And we didn't know, we knew it was bad. Most of us knew it was bad, but we didn't know how bad it was until this president came along and exposed what was really going on. And now these people, they're like roaches. They're running from the light, because they've been hiding in the darkness for so long, and the president is shining the light on them, and they're running nuts. When the president, if he said the same about Haiti and El Salvador and Africa, it's a true. If you look at those countries, they are assholes. And instead of complaining about it, why not fix the problem? Why not pretend? Why are you pretending that the problem doesn't exist? And that's what the liberals and the Democrats have been doing. They don't want to solve the problem. They want the people brainwashed, dumbed down, and demoralized. Look at Black Americans, for example. Not all, but most Black Americans are brainwashed, dumbed down, and demoralized, and they have been kept that way since Lyndon B. Johnson. For the last 40 to 50 years or so, they have told Black Americans that you can't make it in America, the greatest country on this side of heaven, by the way. They have told them you can't make it because of racism. Now we find out that racism never existed. It's a lie that's been made up by the children of the lie in order to control. I was born on a plantation. Born in Alabama on a plantation.
What we've found out recently is there's only one racist in the world, and he lives in the White House. Again, this is nonsense. I mean, you know, we can go partisan here, and that's fine. I mean, it tells me the Democrats don't have anything to say. Liberals don't have anything to say. I mean, he was a Russian agent. Now he's a racist. Okay, what are they going to try next? I don't know. Ron, one of the fascinating things about gaslighting is that as much as the media hates Trump and Trump hates the media, it's a symbiotic relationship. They need each other. It's like they're both balls of fire and the other is oxygen. And this is what drives me nuts, because it's not pushing forward an agenda for people that genuinely need help. And the U.S. is in dire straits now, and we're not getting policy fixes. You know, Trump is on this. It's a great presidency, the greatest year of any. That's all nonsense. Not much has happened, okay? And this is dreadful. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. And you know, I certainly do not think that Trump is a great president at all. But one thing that's happening is I think people are waking up to, you know, just a system where, you know, you have one side, you have the Democrats that pretty much give you nothing to vote for. And then you have the Republicans that give people something to vote against. And I think people are waking up to this. And the media, which has an incentive to uphold the status quo because they're benefiting from it.
Absolutely.
You know, they make it out like, you know.
Keep going, Ron.
I'm paying a lot of attention.
Yeah,
I've been paying a lot of attention, sir.
Not if you haven't
realized
that
a tax bill that pretty much helps the 1%.
Gentlemen,
that helps the 1%.
Please don't.
That's not true.
That helps the 1%.
Hang on, guys.
And I'm not in the 1%.
That's not true.
Don't talk over each other.
People going back to work.
Okay. Yes, I mean.
People are going back to work. Black Americans are going back to work. They're getting bonuses. The jobs are now opening up again. You're seeing small businesses starting up again. So Ron is not being honest. The president has cut back on restrictions and regulations. We are safer now under this president, and especially since the fall of Messiah, the worst president that this country has ever experienced, Barack Obama. I mean, he is going down in history as the most hated, worst president.
Jesse, let me jump in here.
Jesse, hang
on, let me jump in here. Rob, let me go to Rob before we go to the break here. I think one of the interesting things that I find very curious here is that it's hard to tell what is truly happening, because if you just go into these echo chambers, it's all bad or it's all good. And I don't believe either one of them. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, I'm a political centrist, and I'm a left-leaning political centrist, and as you have said to me, you're a right-leaning political centrist, Peter, and we need more of that. That's what this country is based on bipartisanship and deal-making. I think a big problem we're having here with looking at anything that the Trump administration has accomplished or not accomplished is he can't keep his mouth shut and his fingers off those tweets, because somebody said, and this was a commentator who doesn't care for him. Let me finish, please, Jesse. If Trump just remained silent and did not tweet and did not make the stupid comments that he made, he'd probably have a much higher rating right now in popularity with the country, with a lot of people. But he can't seem to control himself. He's an emotional equivalent of a child.
Okay, Jesse, 20 seconds.
Would you not being honest about if the president wasn't tweeting, if he wasn't speaking up, we wouldn't know the truth of what he's doing, because the liberal media hate him so much, they're not talking about his successes because they don't want you to know the impact that he's having on this country.
Okay, gentlemen,
in a positive
way. I'm going to jump in here.
Yeah, they hate him so much they gave him billions of
dollars
of coverage.
We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on gaslighting. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Ron in Los Angeles. You know, Ron, I don't really learn much from the news, okay, at all, okay? And that goes for CNN, MSNBC, Fox, okay? I love the Jimmy Dore show.
That makes two of us.
I love the Jimmy Dore show. I learn a lot from you guys. But you know what I do learn from the mainstream media is I learn these words like trigger and microaggression. And I always find it so curious, okay, because Trump is accused of being a trigger for this and a trigger for that. But it seems to me the mainstream media is just one huge trigger that goes off once in a while. And we go through an entire cycle of people crying and beating their fist and beating their chest. And, you know, how can this happen to our country? Who is? I mean, I just find, you know, what are they all auditioning for something? Because I just find it, you know, where's the news? And then I tried to change the channel. It's the same thing on the next channel, just a different face. I mean, is this what corporate culture's gotten down to? I mean, is it getting to the point, what's the oldest man that can cry the loudest now on public airwaves? Okay, this is what it's gone down to me. I mean, it you should turn to the cartoon channel. At least you'll feel better. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, well, the corporate media in the United States, you know, it's very much owned by corporate interests. You know, I mean, MSNBC, for instance, is owned by Comcast. So, I mean, right away, you just have conflict of interest 101 and the fact that they are just so profit driven. You know, they tend to focus on hyperbole and sensationalism instead of really objectively unpacking what's going on in the country. And if they were to do that, they would find out that the status quo is really broken and we need to make some sharp turns in regards to policy. So they don't really want to do that. Instead, it's more fun to focus on, you know, instances of sensationalism. You know, I mean, you brought up the S-hole example, for instance. You know, that was talked about for, you know, a couple news cycles and ongoing. Meanwhile, you know, all the people that are supposed to be, quote unquote, resisting Trump voted for a FISA bill that pretty much extends the ability of any president to pursue surveillance. They also didn't push back on the whole idea for the wall. Nobody talked about the fact that DACA didn't move forward because of this wall idea, which I think is an awful idea. Most Americans don't want. I think it's a racist idea. We don't even know how much it's going to cost. Trump's going to try to privatize everything. So basically, he would use this to make his friends richer. Nobody's talking about these actual policy issues that we need to be discussing.
You know,
instead, it's just focusing on something else Trump said.
You know, let me stay with Ron here. You know, Ron, what's really interesting is that I'm kind of ambiguous about the wall. You're against it. But that would be an interesting conversation to have, wouldn't it? OK, instead, let me go to Ron.
And we haven't
here.
Had it.
Right. But instead, I'll show you how the mainstream media does it. OK, Rob, if you're for the wall, you're a racist. End of conversation. I mean, Rob, this is what I find, again, really troublesome is that if you disagree with me, then somehow you're immoral or lack morals. I mean, again, that's the discourse.
No middle ground.
Yeah, go ahead, Rob. Go ahead to New York.
There's no middle ground. There's no nuance. There's no discussion. You're right. It's become an either or circumstance. And I just want to backtrack a little bit to what Ron said before the break, because I think it's really important. And Peter, you and I have discussed this, which is you had certain programs that really championed Trump, like MSNBC Morning Joe. Joe and Mika had him on every day and gave him so much airtime. It was remarkable. And now they suddenly seem stunned that he's the president of the United States. And they're profiting now on both ends because all they do is beat the Trump stories to death. But I do think that it's our obligation in the media to report things. And we owe it to the viewers and the public and our listeners to talk about more important issues. Like, if Trump has passed really bad legislation, then let's talk about it. I never see it discussed or shown on any of these shows or programs anywhere, really, about the new legislation that's gone through regarding Wall Street, regarding regulations. What's happening? We're just talking about people's opinion, as my grandmother used to say, yatata, yatata, yatata.
You've said that before. I really like that. You know, Jesse, one of the things that I find very interesting, and it's this kind of boomerang effect here. You know, during the campaign, anyone, according to the Clinton people, if you supported Donald Trump, you were deplorable. Well, you know, I come from the Midwest. I don't like being called a deplorable, particularly from someone that I think has no moral standing whatsoever in the public eye, and that's Hillary Clinton and her Klan. Okay, and now it's the same thing. The same thing is happening. Is the more these morning joke and meager, as I call them, they go after the president, the more in the heartland people are going to say, aha, see? These people on the coast, I know you, Ron, I know you guys are on L.A. You guys get a free pass from me, okay? Just on this one program, okay? Because I hate California. I lived in California. I hate California. I really do, okay? But, I mean, if
it's sunny here.
It's not now where I am, okay? So don't rub it in. But let me stay here with Jesse. No, but I think that, again, you know, a lot of people in the Midwest where his supporters are, you know, the more, and because we say we should talk about the issues, you know, and are these programs creating jobs and the right kind of jobs? You know, that's the kind of conversation we should all be having. But, you know, if the MSNBC says, you know, he's stealing the livelihood of the people in the Midwest, they're going to, and they beat him for it, he's only going to sustain his popularity because he's hated by the mainstream media, not based on his real record, real or imagined. Go ahead, Jesse.
I do want to just first respond to Ron about the wall. One of the reasons that President Trump is president is because he is in support of putting up a big, beautiful wall. And that's not racist to put up a wall to protect the American citizens.
It's not going
to
be anything big or beautiful about it, Jesse.
And what I would like for Ron to do, if he thinks it's okay not to put a wall up, to go and live in the inner cities, in the urban areas, and see what Black Americans are going through as a result of the wall not being there. You have illegal aliens coming across the borders. They are landing in the urban areas in Black communities. They are hurting Blacks in the area of education, health care. They are bringing MS-13 gang violence. They are bringing drugs. And then they hate Black people. Black people are having to move out of their areas to the South, either to Georgia or Alabama, because the radical, liberal, godless Democrats and the liberal media, godless media, will not expose the negative impact that open borders are having on Black people. And I realize now it's just including godless John Lewis and the Wicked Witch from the West, Maxine Waters. But the liberals don't care about Black people. They only want their vote. And that's why they want the wall down. They don't want a wall there because these illegals are coming in and they are giving the illegals free stuff in the same manner that they've done to Blacks for the last 50 years or so. And they are seducing
You're making some gross generalizations.
They don't care about Black people at all.
Ron,
and so,
let me go to Ron here.
The people voted for the president because he will put a big, beautiful wall up.
Okay.
And you see CNN and all those people, they're crying. Oh, we're so hurt for the Black people.
Well, no.
We love
okay.
them. If you love
let me,
Black people,
let me go
you
to,
treat
come
them
on,
like
come on, Jesse. Jesse, I need equal time. I need equal time for everyone here. Ron, okay? All right, let's take the wall as an example here. Depending on what cable station I go to, it's a good idea, it's a bad idea. But I never really hear experts explain why it's bad, why it's good. All I hear is moral preening all the time. Oh, it's immoral. You know, you're racist. But tell me, how is the wall going to work? How much is it going to cost?
Well,
how does it change reality?
Exactly.
How is it part of a larger immigration? Because I'm for immigration reform. See, this is the stuff I want to know, but I never learn any of it. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, and all right, let's put the moral argument aside, because, you know, we definitely do not have consensus there. I think it's a morally disgusting idea.
Okay.
But that's a moral judgment call. So let's look at it economically. We don't know exactly how much it's going to cost. We don't even know. There's a lot of numbers that have been thrown out there.
It doesn't matter.
Furthermore, Donald Trump wants to privatize the entire thing. So this would just be given to contractors, and let's be honest, this is a big billionaires club that none of us are in. Jesse, you're not in it. I'm not in it. Peter, you're not in it. Rob, you're not in it. We are not in it. So this would just be Donald Trump padding the pockets of his friends.
Don't be too sure, Ron.
All we would get out of this. And
sure.
It wouldn't be, all right, well then I guess you're in the club and maybe you're for the wall because you have a financial incentive to be so.
Okay, but this is proving my point.
Hang on, let me follow up on what Ron has said.
Yes, go right ahead, because this is what I'm trying to get at, gentlemen, is to have a discussion about policy. Okay, go ahead, Rob.
What's Ron brings up a really good point. Let's forget about the moral issue here, because I'm against the wall, but I've done my research, and I did it years ago when I did my due diligence. All you have to do is Google Inspector General Border Wall, and you will see the billions and billions and billions of money that we've not only spent, but wasted. We have tried to build walls. We've tried to put up motion detectors. We've tried to use satellites. Every single thing the government has tried to implement under Democrat and Republican presidencies have failed because it's been proven untenable and unbuildable. But we had a presidential candidate that knew nothing and cared nothing about this and told people that he was going to build it. It's not ridiculous. It's right there. Google the Inspector General's report. You could see the money that's been spent on it. And that's what should be discussed. How are we going to build it?
Why don't you check with Israel? If you believe a wall don't work, won't work, check with Israel. And also, if you believe
you're comparing apples and oranges, tear down the wall around your house.
Why don't you tear down the wall around your home?
All right, gentlemen.
I think it's always better
to take down walls. I think we built one on this program. Many thanks to my kids in Los Angeles and in New York. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.